Who here is from Chicago? Okay. Good thing. That's the love that Baltimore gives the world. So I start with Chicago because when I was trying to figure out how to begin, I was curious about what I should do first, and then it became real obvious to me that in the past year, which seems in some ways really far away, this past October, Officer Jason Van Dyke was convicted on a second-degree murder charge and 16 counts of aggravated battery for the 2014 murder of Laquan McDonald. Yeah. So this conviction was only achieved because of the hard work of years of us in Chicago engaging in street protests, courtroom disruptions, legal battles, civil disobedience, press conferences, and more street protests. The murder of the 17-year-old McDonald in the fall of 2014 politically shook the city. It forced a wave of resignations when the videotape of his killing was released a year later. The city spent $5 million to cover up the tape. And I think it's also pretty uncontroversial to say that Mayor Rahm Emanuel chose not to run for re-election this past spring because of his complicity in the cover-up of the murder and the fact that it was coming to trial right when the election season swung into gear. When McDonald was executed with 16 shots in the fall of 2014, the city tried to suppress the damning video. The reason why they did that is because what was happening around the country. Sparked by the murders of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and Eric Garner in New York City, a wave of protests against anti-black racism and police murder was sweeping the country. People were in motion in the streets, an angry, defiant protest. An angry, defiant protest is always something that terrifies those in power. Fearing these protests, Emanuel worked to try to suppress this video, as the grainy, horrifying images of police terror that were seen in every American city were feeding the swelling movement that came to be known as the Black Lives Matter movement. In a country built on slavery, that has anti-black racism so thoroughly cooked into its structure, movements against racism have, for our entire history, from slave rebellions through radical reconstruction, civil rights, urban rebellions in the black power of the late 60s, the LA rebellion, Oscar Grant, Trayvon Martin, all these things strike at the core of this country that they call the land of the free. There's an explosive reverberation every time there's a fight against anti-black racism. And through the street protests around BLM, despite the fact that they've largely subsided in the way they were in 2014, we see that there's a radicalization in the ideas around racism and policing specifically that still rings through the politics in this movement. We see that in the current discussion and sadly debate around the question of reparations that's happening on the national stage. We saw it in the wave of anthem protests just recently, sort of in the past year. I think we also see it in the new popularity of the idea of abolishing the police. It's kind of the applause at the beginning of this session, I think, reflects it to a certain way. What was once considered a more extreme idea that was perhaps only bandied about in rooms with badass people such as this has gotten more purchase in activist circles and even discussed some in broader politics. I don't know if you saw the CNN roundtable just last year in which a Chicago activist actually called for abolishing the police in that sort of way, sparked a certain kind of conversation. The very idea that the police, as well as the prisons, the courts, and the whole carceral system are not needed and that they should be discarded in the dustbin of history, it's definitely not sort of a mainstream idea yet. But I think it's more a part of the political milieu of the left. It's more the accepted understanding assumption of people who are trying to fight against anti-black racism and police terror specifically. DSA's resolution 2 years ago in support of police abolition is one reflection of that, this idea entering more the mainstream. So this radicalization of consciousness around policing and anti-black racism is fantastic, and I think that we should embrace it entirely, and also I want to argue we want to push it as far as it can go. So in this talk, I want to kind of talk about the case for abolition, but also in doing so, I actually want to argue for a slight shift in emphasis about how abolition is discussed and strategized generally in the movements. I want to argue that general conceptions around abolition are based on a framework that underestimates the question of state and power, that as activists, these questions, we need to bring them more into the fore, as they strike more firmly at the very nature of the police and the role they play in this society. the question of why the police exist, what role they play, and how we can achieve their abolition is one that I think that we should push further than the current discourse allows. And I think that that pushing of it being further is not only needed, but necessary if we want to win the thing that we're talking about, which is having no more police on the streets. So, before getting into a general case around abolition that I think can take up the discussion, I want to describe a bit about how I characterize the common framework of how police abolition is discussed. In doing so, I want to note that while I'm making a critique of a certain kind, I'm doing it from a position in complete solidarity with the people doing the work, and I think there's a lot of worthwhile reforms that need to be fought around, and I'm a part of fighting for those reforms, and I think if we're not doing that, then we're not worth our salt. At the same time, I think that we can make critiques about how some of this stuff is politically laid out, and that's what I'm going to talk about. The very championing of the idea of abolition itself is important, as is the product, the project of delegitimizing the police. A lot of what goes on is this sort of thing, delegitimizing their use and making it seem more alien, the fact of these things that they do and carry out on the day-to-day. So if you walk away from this talk thinking that I'm just saying revolution and nothing else, and I've missed my mark. The relationship between reforms and revolution is a dialectical one, but the fact that it's a dialectical one also means we have to talk about the revolutionary change as well. There's this emphasis and an interplay that I think shifts too far oftentimes to that of reforms. And a political project that is built around reforms misses the mark in the end, if not also connected to a kind of revolutionary change that raises the horizon of what is needed if we actually want to take up the process of abolishing the police, if we actually want to take on ending the thing which exists as the monopolization of violence in the hands of the most powerful capitalist state in the world. Like, we should be serious about what that task is. So what is the framework that's often sort of described as such? It often goes like this. We must abolish the police. Yay, that's great. So in order to dismantle the police, often what it says is that what we have to do is we have to decrease our reliance on the police, and that we need to work to create viable alternatives in our community. What this looks like is often a focus on creating organizations that provide services in the community, such as peace circles, grassroots mental health resources, domestic violence stuff, and all that. In Chicago, there was an encampment across from a black torture site, Holman Square, called Freedom Square, that said it was envisioning itself as creating this abolitionist space. The creation of these alternatives, of the services that people say that we need and that we do need, often means creating 501c3 nonprofits that attempts to get grant money for these alternative programs. These projects are often paired with educational efforts that encourage people to seek out or create alternatives to policing, and more importantly, to not call the police. Again, those are all good things. Generally, they're good ideas. So one example of this, to be maximally concrete, is the group Critical Resistance, which is a great organization started by Angela Davis and Ruth Wilson Gilmore that really need to be credited with popularizing the idea of abolishing the prison industrial complex and doing some of the initial activism that now is more commonplace. I think they deserve a lot of credit for that. So this organization has a workshop on abolishing the police. Half of it is really great history of policing, describing its racist origins, and those sorts of things. The other half is on building alternatives. In it, it features a small group activity where participants sit down and they discuss a various series of scenarios, such as a neighbor's domestic violence incident, a mental health crisis, a break-in, etc. And then the participants are asked how they would respond with the following questions, and this is a quote. One, how do you react during and after the incident in ways that do not involve or mitigate the effect of the police, courts, or other parts of the prison industrial complex? Two, what resources exist in your community that you could use? What resources are missing and that you'd like to see? And three, how can you support both the people who are harmed and the people doing the harm in a way that makes the community stronger? So all these are good and interesting questions, and I think very worthwhile and thought-provoking to talk about on an individual basis. Like, they're good questions, and I think that they warrant a discussion. But for me, it also raises another question. Is the perceived lack of alternatives to policing the reason why they continue to exist? U.S. cities give $100 billion annually to the police, plus another $80 billion to prisons, $5 billion to the Border Patrol. And in some places like Chicago and Oakland, close to 40% of the city's total budget goes to the old boys in blue. Is this allocation of resources and backing because of a lack of imagination on behalf of the governed? Do the police exist because regular working class people are too reliant on them? Do cops patrol the streets because black working class people have to call them for mental health emergencies? As bad as it is, does the random racist white person who calls the police on black barbecuers prop up the entire edifice of violence and terror? I think to all those questions, I would say the answer that is no. And that the role that the police play is for the ruling class, and that is an essential one we have to understand if we want to properly talk about how to actually get rid of them entirely. It's a question we should sort of take up. So in doing so, I want to sort of focus the next part of my discussion on what the nature of the police is and the role. I gave a similar talk last year that focused a lot more on the history and are the police workers. I'm not going to go too much in history now, so if the history interests you, it's on wearemini.org. You should go listen to it. But I want to sort of make some of the general case, because I think that's important to sort of take on now. So understanding the role that police play and whose interests they operate in is essential. The police are a fairly modern institution. They came into being all within the course of a few decades that corresponds with the development of capitalism in the large urban city in the 1820s to 1850s. During these decades of the early city, there were numerous uprisings, rebellions, and strikes by what would be called by the elites as the dangerous classes. This was kind of the coverall that they gave for white workers, immigrants, enslaved African peoples, and free black folks. 70% of America's cities with a population over 20,000 saw major disorders of the first half of the 19th century, and the threat of slave rebellion haunted the slaveocracy. The early formation of capitalism was happening at the same time, consolidated this new class of workers, and it was a violent and chaotic process. As Marx says, all history is the history of class struggle, and the cops are the intervention by the ruling class on the side of that struggle against these uprisings that were plaguing every American city. Before that, there was no such thing as the police as we commonly understood them. There were certain institutions like constables and the Night's Watch, but they were largely volunteer, often passive, and didn't have the same power to arrest in the same way, and they also lacked the specific threat of violence that the police right now specifically carry. In the American South, there's also another institution that would be transformed into the police, and that is the slave patrol, also called alarm men or searchers. So these were a vigilante group of citizens, hired by the plantations and often supplying their own weapons. Urbanization of the southern cities consolidated the enslaved population in connection, in greater connection than before was spread out on plantations. And so the threat of slave rebellions became more pronounced and more difficult to manage. And social controls like curfews and restrictions on movement on black folks, both free and enslaved, were implemented to try to hamper the organizing that was going on behind sort of these uprisings. So that created a more permanent and centralized force that then became the modern police the police force in the South. A Charlestonian from 1845 described the change, why they wanted to implement this, in perversely antiseptic language. But they say, in the rural setting, a mere occasional riding about and general supervision of a patrol may be sufficient. But some more energetic and scrutinizing system is absolutely necessary in cities, where from the very denseness of population and closely contiguous settlements, there must be need of closer and more careful circumspection. Circumspection, like that's a weird word to use, but you know, we know how they talk. So these threats posed to the rich and powerful by strikes and rebellions in the North and insurrections or self-emancipations of the slave blacks in the South required a new institution to meet the social conditions of crowds and struggle that was the birth of the growth of capitalism. So what was required was, to quote Marxist police historian Sidney Herring, quote, a full-time, permanent force capable of continuously asserting the power of the capitalist state up and down every street in every city. And so that was what the police was. Assembled piecemeal, based on that same idea, through a process of trial and error, the constables and the Night's Watch, as well as the slave patrols in the South, were basically all fused into one professional standing body of armed individuals whose main job, then as in now, was two things. One, patrol in order to police working class neighborhoods and through the threat of armed force maintain order and protect private property with obviously special surveillance given to the control of black people, both enslaved and free. And the second was to manage crowds, to make sure that when people tried to protest, strike, or organize, they would break it up and quell dissent. These two main functions, the patrol function and to break up crowds, are the main function of the police in the late 1800s, and it still is now. This new force was modeled explicitly on techniques of colonization and occupation. In addition to its origin in the slave patrols, there are other roots of the family tree that go back to nefarious places as well. What's considered the first modern police force, the London Metropolitan Police, was created in 1829 by a guy named Robert Peel. He developed his ideas for the new force from serving the British government maintaining British colonial control of Ireland. Peel found that uniformed soldiers of the British Army, or local militias, were good at fighting wars, but were not well equipped for maintaining order, as they often further inflamed Irish resistance by firing on crowds, were expensive to maintain, and the visual of occupying troops in foreign uniforms was difficult for the colonized to stomach, for obvious reasons. So he developed a different force, the Royal Irish Constabulary, which is a more effective body for colonial domination. He's basically hired to create the same force in London, and that's how the London police were created. So then when the Boston police was established in 1838, they sought to, quoting the policymakers at the time, to, quote, imitate as far as it may be the system of London. So they're like, we should do this here too. New York City followed with the creation of the Day and Night Police in 1844, and the modern police force in the U.S. was born. That's the origins of it. So what about crime? This is often the thing that people say, well, it's not about order, it's about sort of fighting crime. It's the repeated justification people tell us for the police. Despite what they say, even with the creation of the early force, fighting crime basically had nothing to do with their design. In Boston, for example, crime went down from 1820 to 1830, for the decade before the creation of the department. In the city marshal report of 1824, crime wasn't even mentioned. The city marshals weren't concerned about that thing which is called crime. So rather, again, it's the patrol function that then and now receives the most police resources, with the goal being a regular police presence that's prepared to intervene with the ever-potential threat of violence. It is this threat that's the special tool of the police, as their every intervention, they don't always lead with the violence, though they're really quick to do it, but their every intervention has the promise of violent force. You know, step out the car, or I'm going to do this thing to you. Like, this, the expectation of violence, they hold behind it. And this is independent of the individual cop. You know, the threat of violence is the institution, not even the individual cop per se. Indeed, the role of the detective, so the person who supposedly goes around solving crimes if you watch TV, didn't exist in American police departments for the first 50 to 75 years of their existence. More testament to what the function of the institution was. The first tool of the cop is the nightstick, the truncheon, the weapon to force compliance and discipline crowds, not the magnifying glass or the fingerprint kit. So we must dispel the conventional mythology of the role of the police. Since the beginning of the police, from 200 years to now, still the main way that people catch people who commit crime is by someone who sees the crime coming and telling someone else who did it. Like, it's not like investigation. That doesn't happen. Sorry, viewers of CSI. So it doesn't take a big body of swaggering men with guns to go around and wait for someone to tell you who does the crime. The majority of policemen make only one felony arrest per year, and most of the time they're on patrol. They're just going around looking for bad shit to get in. The overwhelming arrests that they carry out are for minor drug offenses and what are so-called quality of life offenses, such as public drunkenness, vagrancy, public urination, unlicensed street vending, and other things. Policing these small offenses aggressively is a common practice that's called broken windows or order maintenance policing. In addition, police are also not a preventative measure for reducing crime. Sociological studies, there's no correlation between the size of a police force per capita and the reduction of crime rate. Indeed, it's often the case that places with higher per capita police forces sometimes have higher rates of crime. I think Chicago's murder rate is an example of that. Very high murder rate, despite the fact that per capita we have a giant fucking police department. To prove this, there's an interesting study done last year in the journal Nature on the period of time when the NYPD were throwing a temper tantrum because the mayor gave them a limp criticism of the murder of Eric Garner. So during this tantrum, the NYPD stopped carrying out what they called necessary arrests for a short period of time. Again, the fact that they say there's certain things that are, not necessary. So the arrest rate during this period of time, in which the NYPD decided we're not going to carry out unnecessary arrests, the arrest rate for minor drug arrests and quality of life offenses, of course, plummeted. People, like, loved it. They're like, this is great. I'm not getting tickets for stupid things. And New York City did not descend into a spiral of chaos, believe it or not. But so on top of that, those are kind of obvious things, but on top of that, the researchers found that the reporting of major crimes, so felony, robbery, murder, and assault, all fell by half during the time of the slowdown. So this is not the amount of crimes investigated or reported by the police, but the number that were reported by the population during the same sort of time. It's very clear there's no correlation to this. So cops are bad at solving crime, stopping crime, and preventing it. So I think if we sort of take a step back, there's also an element even to sort of critique the concept of crime itself. I think, you know, this is something they sort of talk about as well. The very nature of what is the target of enforcement and arrest and whatnot is always skewed away from things that actually harm society, pollution by the big corporations, the U.S. military, etc. And I think some of that pulls back the curtain and shows what the purpose of laws. Laws are not the framework upon which society operates, but law is a product of how society operates. Laws are the product of class society and are designed to serve those at the top. To quote some guy named Freddie Ingalls in The Condition of the Working Class in England, he said, "Certainly the law is sacred to the bourgeoisie, for it is of its own making, put through with his approval and for his protection and benefit. He knows that even if a particular law may injure him as an individual, sometimes they get caught with silly crimes, still the complex of legislation as a whole protects his interests. He holds it to be holy, and that the policeman's club, which is really his own club, holds a power for him that is wonderfully reassuring. But for the worker, it certainly does not. The worker knows only too well and from too long experience that law is the rod the bourgeois holds over his head." The other dynamic of the myth of cops as crime fighters also has to be figured in is how crime has been racialized, or to quote Naomi Morikawa, how the problem of racism in society has been criminalized. After the destruction of chattel slavery, the myth of black criminality was used as a justification for the construction of various apparatuses of repression in order to maintain control and restrict the freedom dreams of black America. Jim Crow, the new Jim Crow, you know, the prison industrial complex, all that. This was in the interest of the ruling class because of the way the entire class order of the United States was in some ways built on racist oppression. This interest is quite explicit. The first sociological study that actually linked criminal behavior to black skin to try to sort of be evidence of this was Frederick L. Hoffman's 1896 Race Traits and Tendencies of the Negro American. So Hoffman was an employee of Prudential Insurance, and the study was created in order to allow Prudential to deny selling insurance to the newly freed African-American population after the Civil War. The originators of broken windows theory was informed a lot, which has informed a lot of contemporary police practice. George Kelling and James Q. Wilson blamed culture for poverty in a way that resembles the racist eugenicists like Charles Murray and Herbert Spencer. The connection of the notion of criminality to black people has been remarkably resilient from the rulers, from Johnson's Omnibus Crime and Safe States Act, as a result of the ghetto rebellions in the 60s, to Nixon's law and order dog whistle politics, Reagan's war on drugs, Clinton's crime bill, and now Trump's sort of doom and gloom apocalyptic rants about our fair city of Chicago. All this serves to both justify the occupation of black communities by trigger-happy cops and as an explanation for poverty and inequality that especially affects black folks in this burning house of America. So, we've established they're bad at solving crime, preventing crime. They're also horrible at keeping people safe. Cops have a record of overreacting and making situations worse up to the point of killing. Obvious. Indeed, according to a study that was done in The Guardian, people who suffer from mental illness are 20% more likely to be murdered by a cop. No expert trained in how to deal with mental illness says that this is the best way to sort of intervene. The very fact that most people are left with the only option of calling the cops in these situations is due to the fact that budget cuts done to preserve the profits of the rich have robbed us of all the services that could articulate some kind of community plan for these types of situations. So only the police remain. They've stripped all the services out of certain places and they've only had the police who are sort of mitigating and having order over the symptoms of the system that's been laid out. It represents the warped funding priorities of the state and the ruling class, and not actually any kind of actual consideration about how to appropriately deal with social problems. It's absurd that the police are the lead agency, oftentimes in our communities, in dealing with homelessness, mental illness, school discipline, youth unemployment, immigration, sex work, drug abuse, and more. It makes no sense that police are the lead institution in carrying those things out. Cop intervention is always more risky when whatever crisis situation that they enter. So they did a study that found that more than 3/4 of all homicides are done by someone the victim knows. So oftentimes someone that you know is the person who shoots you. The random guy in the alley is sort of an illusory threat. The serial killer, not that big of a threat. Sorry, CSI viewers, I'm just destroying your dreams. So if you were killed by someone that you don't know, it's a 1 in 3 chance it'll be a cop. Also, the Free Thought Project also did a recent study that found that the amount of assets seized by the police exceeds the total amount stolen by robberies nationwide. Cops are the biggest robbers. So cops are not only socially useless, but they're actually a social problem. I think we have to sort of understand it as that. So this ties into why we need to push beyond some of the stuff about alternatives, because these aren't situations in which there's no alternative. This is situations that are created by what the police do. The overwhelming majority of these times that we hear about, when cops shoot down black and brown people, are not instances of cops making mistakes in difficult life or death situations. Alton Sterling was selling CDs. Philando Castile, Wallace Scott, and Sandra Bland were pulled over for routine traffic stops. Freddie Gray made eye contact with a cop, and that was all needed for a death sentence. Eric Garner was selling cigarettes. Tamir Rice and Rakia Boyd were playing in parks. Michael Brown was walking in the streets, and Stephon Clark was in his own backyard. These are not examples of conflicts that police had to intervene in. There's no wrong that to a member of the community that had to be righted. Virtually all these killings were the result of racially profiled routine stops, suspicion of drug possession or distribution, and these so-called quality of life offenses. We don't need alternative methods for cops to use in these situations. We just need them to stop intervening in these situations. So this role they play in society provides an explanation as to also why the police behave as a collective social bloc in a way that is a ruthless force of reaction. This is quite explicit, and they talk about it openly, and you could do a whole talk on this, but I just want to give a couple of examples. So there was a recent ProPublica investigation that found a closed Facebook group called I'm 1015, where Border Patrol agents routinely made racist comments and joked about the death of migrants. The report from ProPublica stated, "Seems to be a pervasive culture of cruelty aimed at immigrants within the CPB. This isn't just rogue agents or bad apples." Right. This is what the report said. The Facebook group, I'm 1015, is made up of 9,500 people. The total employment of the Border Patrol is 20,000. So roughly 50% are on this Facebook group that are making these comments. Similarly, the Plain View Project scoured the public social media account. So this is things that they're saying in public from 8 police departments and found, not surprisingly, a dearth of racism, making light of police violence, endorsing people driving cars into crowds of protesters and other vigilanteism, and praising George Zimmerman. It's a good day for a chokehold, one post proclaimed. I'm going to protect and serve the shit out of you, another post proclaimed. As a result of this reporting, 75 officers in Philadelphia were put on desk duty, the largest number ever disciplined in the city of Philadelphia. It's so pervasive. It's not bad apples. It's the whole bunch, so to speak. And this is the reason why every time that the police murder an innocent black person, it's the FOP representative who's the first up, not only to defend the killer cop, but then to slander the victim of often the most grotesque racist ways possible. This is the reason why, per a special study by Reuter called Protecting the Blue, that in 82 major cities, police union contracts had a pervasive pattern on various protections for officers facing allegations of abuse and hurdles for the public to fire complaints. This is the reason why police unions around the country were solid supporters of the Trump campaign and why the Blue Lives Matter flag has become a fixture of the newly confident Nazi and white supremacist movement. At least the Nazis are honest when they admit that being pro-cop means anti-black. It's important to note that there's no resistance to this. The culture of silence and solidarity within the cop ranks profoundly ensures that there's no criticism within the ranks. This is a product, again, of the social relationship of their class, which is important because police culture, this is the thing that liberals talk about and that they want to change, is socially created by the institution, not the other way around. So you have to get rid of the institution. They may be a minute handful of individuals who've spoken up at great personal risk, but if you compare it with resistance in the military, there's no comparison. Unlike the military, where during every major war, there is some kind of mass resistance, defections during the American Civil War, soldier mutiny, ending World War II, GI resistance to the point of killing officers in Vietnam, Iraq veterans against the war in Iraq, there's no analogous anything like that in regards to the police, and it's because of the social role that they play. So while cops often come from working class backgrounds, and these days police forces around the country are way more diverse than they were decades before, and don't even get me started about rainbow cop cars, their social position as a repressive apparatus in the vanguard of racism creates the socially cohesive reactionary bloc. As mentioned in my Ingalls quote earlier, the policeman's club is the club of the bourgeoisie. This is why police unions are so staunchly positioned on the right politically, and why no resistance within the police of any significant scale has ever occurred. While there have been a handful of times in which the police, largely under extreme pressure, have come out and not broken up strikes, it is by far something that doesn't happen quite often. Our position is that of Trotsky in writing of the Russian Revolution, where he said that, quote, the police are fierce, implacable, hated, and hating foes. To win them over is out of the question. Our slogan should not be cops join us, but no cops. And if I was speaking to an individual cop, I'd say stop being one. So to answer the question that I asked like 20 minutes ago of why cops exist, it's not because working people and people of color are reliant on them or the lack of alternatives. From the historical origins to the present, the role and function that cops play in society is one that is rooted in their playing a role as the tool of racist class rule. It's the ruling class that's reliant on the police to function as their monopoly on violence and force. The use of this constant threat of violence to quell protest and resistance, protect private property, and occupy populations, especially black and brown ones, is the role they play. Hiding behind the myth of their being crime fighters, they police the symptoms of social crisis of the system they aim to defend. The cops have no social use for us, except as a repressive organization wielded by the ruling class. That understanding has to inform our politics. So fighting for ending police as a long-term goal doesn't mean we don't take part in fighting for reforms in the now. I think they do inform the kind of reforms that we fight for. So we don't want to have special trainings for the police. We want reforms that actually put a muzzle on limiting the violence of the police. The social function of the police means that they carry out violence. We're not going to change that function. It's like a firefighter. If you make a firefighter not fight fires, they're actually not a firefighter. You know, does that make sense? Same sort of thing. So we're not going to change sort of a pig into a pony by carrying out these reforms, but we can try to put a muzzle on that beast by limiting their budgets, by bringing justice to those who have been killed by the police, limiting their weapons, etc., etc. This demonstrates also the limitation, I think, of a reform-only approach and the danger of de-emphasizing the class interests they operate for. It's not a case of convincing working-class people and people of color they don't need the police. We shouldn't be naive enough that also we're going to convince the ruling class to give up this thing that is their central tool for the maintenance of their order. Rather, I think that our task is to fight for reforms, but also connect them with the bigger task of confronting the greater organization of class society and the state they use. There are alternatives that exist for policing that are often not talked about, and they often fall at times of high points of struggle that have an antagonism towards the state machinery pitted by people from below. And I want to talk about some of those instances in the few minutes that I have left. So in many of these instances, alternatives perfect to the police were enacted in fervors of creativity in which the historian of the Spanish Revolution, Ronald Fraser, calls forms that the people invent that go far beyond anything you've dreamt of or read in books. So during the Spanish Revolution in 1937, in many cities, the police were replaced by armed workers, control patrols, that were controlled democratically by barricade committees or village assemblies. Many prisons were closed, and prisoners were freed, like the women's prison in the Revel area of Barcelona, which was freed by everyone, and they left a large banner on the prison that said, "This torture house was closed by the people, July 1936. For a week in 1919, militant workers during the Seattle General Strike took over and ran the city. Order was maintained by an unarmed, arm-banded Labor War Veterans Guard, who only with persuasion and the prestige of the Union patrolled the streets and helped manage crisis. The Major General of the Army, who came in to sort of suppress the general strike, admitted surprise that, quote, he'd never seen so quiet and orderly a city without police. In 2006, in Oaxaca, Mexico, a mass movement started by teachers resulted in the self-management of the city for 6 months. During that time, a group of unarmed volunteers, the Cuerpo de Totopeles, modeled on indigenous principles of restorative justice, went around and managed conflict and carried out duties that are sometimes associated with policing. The case of the Russian Revolution of 1917, I think, displays this further because the state itself was abolished, if you will, and replaced by the direct democracy of workers, soldiers, and peasants' councils, Soviets. This Soviet power was described by Lenin as, quote, a new type of state without a bureaucracy, without police, that gives working people legislative and executive authority, that makes them responsible. In the first month of the revolution, the police and the courts were abolished by the decree of the Soviet of People's Commissars concerning the courts, number one. I wanted to tell you all that. Thousands of imprisoned individuals, both political and common law prisoners, were freed, some of them in response to petitions from prisoners' councils. They bandied together and said, you should free these people, and they responded. Elected popular courts were established, and experiments with justice that moved beyond expiation of an offense or atonement offenses were enacted. Bolshevik legal theorists like Yevgeny Pashukhanis saw that, quote, the criminal jurisdiction of the bourgeois state is organized class terror, and attempted to move beyond what he called, quote, the essentially incoherent notion that the severity of each crime can be weighed on a scale and expressed in months and years of imprisonment. Notions of guilt and punishment of individuals were questioned in a way that presaged current conceptions of restorative justice and alternatives to punishment and an understanding of crime that associated as a social problem that needed to be solved collectively. Like this was being sort of undertook in the creativity that couldn't be dreamed up, that couldn't be read in books by people in motion. While many of the popular courts and the tribunals were mainly focused on countering sabotage and counter-revolution, in the early months of the revolution, even in these circumstances, they were handled with astonishingly restorative means, and many members of the previously deposed government military were freed with basically public censure and an oral promise not to do it again. Like, I will not engage in counter-revolutionary activity, sorry, and they're sort of set free. This is an extremely cursory look at the dynamics of the situation in Russia, and I've sort of flown through some examples, but I do that hopefully just to point towards further exploration. Obviously, this rosy picture of Russia particularly, and Spain as well, faded as the revolution tragically degenerated in the face of civil war, imperialist invasion, and the failure of the spreading of the revolution internationally that drove political mistakes of the Bolsheviks and mutated, of course, into the totalitarian police state of Stalin that people think about. Despite this, the Russian Revolution and these others demonstrates another example of kind of a brief moment in the sun of a kind of revolutionary abolitionism. This connection between a final confrontation with the ruling class state demonstrates the fact that, again, it's not a lack of creativity or alternatives of working people that hold back the goal of abolishing the police and prisons, but a lack of power to unleash the creativity and resources to tackle the social problems that the police poorly pretend to remedy. How much time do I have left?
1 minute.
Lastly, so more recently, I could talk more about this. I'm just going to sort of throw this out. We can talk about discussion, talk about it at the end. But the Arab Spring of uprisings and revolutions that began in 2010 are not commonly thought of as anti-police organizing. But if you look at it just a little bit sort of closer, you see that's a feature that runs throughout it all. In Tunisia, where it all kicked off, Mohamed Bouazizi, who he went and he set himself on fire, sparked off the revolution, he did it in front of a police station, and he did it because the police took his wares and beat him in public, and he depended on his wares for his daily sort of stuff. Those protests led to the Arab Spring and the fall of the president, Zine Abidine Ben Ali. Similarly, in Egypt, the organizing that eventually culminated in the protests in Tahrir really are rooted in the organizing of a murder in 2010 of a 28-year-old Alexandrian man named Khalid Said. The police in Egypt were notorious. Amnesty International talked about them torturing people all the time. And Egypt actually has as many police as the whole of the United States, despite the fact that they have a quarter of the population. So it was like a massive police state. So in 2010, they planted hash on this guy, Khaled Saeed, and murdered him and basically beat him to the point of disfigurement. The Facebook page that sort of came organizing around that, We Are Khaled Saeed, was the Facebook page that called the first protests in Tahrir. The first day of the protests was on National Policeman's Day, and the first demand was against the Minister of the Interior, who heads the police, a guy named Habib El-Adli. Like, that again unlocked all this rage and anger in Egyptian society and led to the fall of Mubarak. But it's this organizing around the police and the way that it particularly hits upon and sort of provokes the understanding that actually we don't live in a democratic society, really sort of bring those to the fore. So as the revolution in Egypt sort of went on, half the police stations in Cairo and 60% in Alexandria were burned to the ground. Police disappeared from the streets, and the revolutionary squares in Tunisia, in Syria, in Egypt were all self-managed and organized in that sort of way. These are only brief snapshots. Again, I can only be really brief about these snapshots that are fleeting, imperfect, and in some cases enacted under great duress, reaction, and civil war. But despite this, they demonstrate brief glances of a kind of revolutionary abolition. And this kind of vision needs to be alongside discussions of alternatives to policing. Restorative justice is wonderful. I love it. I do it all the time. But we also need to be clear that that is not going to bring down the armed wing of the state. We need to sort of include these things in the conversation. So I'll conclude with that. Look forward for the discussion.